This weekend starts right after this.
As a small business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Where have the moonwalks gone? I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
This weekend marks the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing. Hear why it was more than a pioneering milestone and why we haven't been there lately.
On the health front, when what's supposed to be routine eye surgery leads to serious complications and brutal pain.
New York City is preparing for a scooter invasion. Find out who's behind it and how the ride sharing will work.
And missing in Major League Baseball, the formula for repeating as World Series champs.
Just about every other sport, at least in the United States, has done it recently, but not baseball. There's not been a repeat champion in baseball in close to two decades. The last one was in 2000 when the Yankees won their third straight World Series after winning in 1998 and 1999. Since then, nothing.
Wall Street Journal reporter Jared Diamond on the Red Sox trying to understand why repeating is so difficult.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for
man. Seemed an impossible goal. May 25, 1961, the day President Kennedy issued his challenge in an address to Congress to land a man on the moon by the end of the decade and bring him back safely. It's 50 years ago this weekend when U.S. astronauts first walked on the moon. Why haven't we done this recently? We're joined now by Ledge King, national correspondent at USA Today. Ledge, in a memo to LBJ, President Kennedy wanted something he could win.
Kennedy was looking for some kind of response to the Soviets. They had been winning the space race with Sputnik, Sputnik 2. Yuri Gagarin was the first human to orbit. And there was a desperation of a sense that America needed to strike back, needed to show its mettle and win the space race, because at the time the Soviets were walloping the U.S. and especially with the Sputnik moment, there was a lot of concern that the Soviets would potentially launch some kind of weapon from space and that the U.S. would be unable to stop it. There's a memo that's, I'm not sure how widely known it is, that Kennedy wrote before he gave the speech asking to Congress, sort of laying out the plan. And it says, he asks LBJ, do we have a chance of beating the Soviets by putting a laboratory in space or by a trip around the moon or by a rocket to land on the moon and back with a man? And that was sort of the kernel of the beginning of the moon landing back in 1961. And he asked LBJ bluntly, is there any space program which promises dramatic results in which we could win? And that launched this idea, this amazing idea that became reality, as Kennedy promised, by the end of the decade.
Boy, you put a time stamp on it, right? That seemed to work. But I think what we tend to forget is we didn't even have, like, these tools cobbled together, right?
No.
We were starting from scratch here.
Basically, we had done a lot of progress on aviation during the war and after World War II, but the Soviets had clearly focused and concentrated on this effort, and the U.S. was I think at one point there was a famous debate between Nixon and Khrushchev, where Khrushchev boasted about the rockets, and Nixon responded with something like, "Yes, but we have more colored televisions," and some say that may have helped Kennedy defeat Nixon, that there was a sense there wasn't this urgency at stake. We had the brains, we had the know-how, but we didn't have the will. And that changed when Kennedy, in response to Sputnik, in response to Gagarin, said, we need to do something.
We're speaking with Ledge King, national correspondent at USA Today. He's written a piece about how the Apollo 11 moon landing was, yes, a pioneering milestone, but really about winning the space race. Somebody made the comment in your story you quoted saying this may have changed the course of history or maybe the Cold War. What was the point that person was making?
That the Cold War was reaching its height there at the time. Remember that Kennedy had just had a terrible issue with Cuba and the botched Bay of Pigs invasion, and there was a sense that the Soviets were gaining superiority over the U.S. after what seemed like many years of that the U.S. was the better, the more powerful, I should say, superpower. And then the Bay of Pigs came, and the Khrushchev sort of imposed his will, and Kennedy, there was a famous moment where Khrushchev sort of seemed to bully Kennedy. And the moon, the call for the moonshot changed how the perspective of the U.S. sort of was seen in that space race. And it wasn't long after that the U.S. started making important gains. They sent Glenn up in 1962 to orbit the Earth, and then there was a series of other challenges that the U.S. was able to do. And in fact, there's speculation that Kennedy would not have made the speech had Alan Shepard not been successfully launched into space just days before he addressed Congress. If that doesn't happen, Kennedy doesn't give the speech, most likely, and who knows when we go to the moon, if ever. I mean, the Soviets, the Russians, never did.
Why have we stopped going and walking on the moon?
Well, it's expensive, as you may know. And I think there was a sense of been there, done that. We focused on other priorities in space. We ended up creating the space station, the space shuttle program. They were more manageable programs that didn't cost as much. And it's important to note that even at the height of the space race, of the moon mission, public sentiment was not particularly in favor of doing this.
Back in the day, 50 years ago, we saw this as an exciting exploration. Now we probably consider the moon part of some sort of defense strategy, no?
Absolutely. I mean, China is already sending their astronauts to the moon. Russia is contemplating it as well, but China is seen as the bigger threat and having a bigger presence in low Earth orbit. So it's absolutely still a national security issue, and that's essentially how it's being sold.
Nice. Ledge King, national correspondent at USA Today. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business. But you don't have to take our word for it. Take Patty Poppes, president and CEO of Consumers Energy, instead.
All of the innovation that's occurring around robotics, AI, it's happening here in Michigan. We have chemical companies, we have pharmaceutical companies, we have medical device manufacturers. Michigan is a magnet for innovators and dreamers.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.
Glad you're with us. In rare cases, complications from LASIK or cataract surgery can leave patients feeling as if they have shards of glass in their eyes. Researchers are looking to treat the condition known as neuropathic corneal pain, but often the trick is figuring out the diagnosis, since ophthalmologists don't usually treat nerves, and neurologists don't frequently treat eyes. Here's Wall Street Journal's senior writer, Betsy McKay. Betsy, what happens with this?
It's basically a condition that arises when the nerves in the cornea are cut as part of routine surgery, LASIK, or cataract surgery. So what happens, sometimes these nerves don't regenerate properly, and with inflammation, they become hypersensitive. And when they're hypersensitive like that, patients who have had these surgeries just develop this kind of agonizing, excruciating pain that won't go away.
And where's the pain? Is it obviously the eyes, but is it, I don't know, deep in the head, like connected to the brain?
Yeah, so people report different things. In the eye, kind of shooting back into the head. Some people have it going down their face, the side of their face or their cheek, but generally in the area of the eye. And it's, you know, people who have this report it as being very all-consuming. You know, it's nothing like a broken ankle or an extremity or something where you feel it's in one part of your body. Yeah. Somehow they feel it. They feel the pain is all-consuming.
And is it occurring immediately after surgery, or is it something that develops over the course of hours or days?
So in the patients I talked to, some had it, you know, within the first 24 hours. One had it develop 6 weeks later. Another person also had it develop after a certain amount of time. So it's hard to say when it occurs. You know, there's not a lot known about this condition. It doesn't occur very often, but you know, the defining characteristic seems to be this pain, and also feeling pain for things that you don't normally feel pain, like air, you know, air from an air conditioner, for example, touching, you know, going across your eye, that's excruciating. Light is excruciating. So just sort of normal stimuli.
Boy, so is it a constant pain, or it's triggered by something?
Well, so people report that they are in constant pain. It's, you know, made worse by certain things, okay. Light, TV, a draft, that kind of thing. You know, they describe it as this pain you just can't get away from. It never stops.
I can't even imagine. We're speaking with Betsy McKay, senior writer at The Wall Street Journal. She's written a piece entitled When Routine Eye Surgery Leads to Debilitating Pain, which is generally caused by something called neuropathic corneal pain. What struck me, too, was that it's so bad for some folks who are not able to find answers or treatment that they've committed suicide.
Yeah, there have been reports of that, of some people dying by suicide. They're in so much pain. They've also been, you know, patients report feeling very frustrated because they go to their doctors. An ordinary equipment in a regular doctor's office won't see any problem. It doesn't see the nerve damage, or the microscope isn't powered high enough. So they diagnose these people with dry eye, give them treatments for dry eye, but that doesn't work.
Wow.
So imagine if you're in this constant pain and you have a doctor saying, you know, there's nothing more I can do for you. Everything looks normal. Fortunately, this is all starting to change. This, in the last couple of years, this condition is starting to be recognized, and the community, you know, doctors are trying to educate each other and patients more about this.
You pointed out, too, that I think those nerves around the cornea are just generally not good at regenerating.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things about the cornea is that it has the highest density of nerves of any tissue in the body. So there's a lot of nerves in there.
Yeah.
You know, in surgery, the nerves are cut, and in some, you know, small number of cases, it appears to be, they don't regenerate normally. And with this inflammation that you get in your eye after surgery, some people, the inflammation persists, and it makes the nerves hypersensitive. But there is, you know, your cornea is cut during this surgery, and so that means cutting the nerve.
That just sounds brutal. Wall Street Journal senior writer Betsy McKay, 21 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Time for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The businesses of the future are being built today, and Michigan is where they start. Learn more by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity. Suddenly, they're all over Brooklyn and Queens, these shiny black and blue mopeds. Several weeks ago, the scooter-sharing startup Revel dropped 1,000 bikes on the streets. Decals on the mopeds invite anyone to download the Revel app and take a spin. More from This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
Get ready, New Yorkers. A scooter-sharing invasion is here. As Ann Cadet of the Wall Street Journal tells us, 1,000 mopeds are ready to go in the Big Apple. Ann, how did these mopeds end up here?
They kind of appeared around the streets of Brooklyn and Queens. Starting at the very end of May, we've got about 1,000 of them kind of parked around the curbs, and you can see people scooting around on them. They were brought to us by a company called Revel, which is a local startup. And it's a lot like City Bike or Car2Go. Anybody can download an app and join up pretty fast after they get their driver's license and that kind of thing checked and their driving record checked. And you download the app and you give them your credit card, and then you can just hop on a scooter and zoom around. They had kind of a test pilot in one neighborhood in Brooklyn running for about a year in Bushwick that only had about 68 scooters. So going from 68 to 1,000 is a big change.
So is this an agreement between New York City and this company?
They told me that they reached out to a lot of local politicians and the police precincts and the community boards and the Department of Transportation, but they actually didn't need any permission. It's legal to ride a moped in the streets. All of the mopeds have driver's licenses. They didn't really need to do anything to get permission. Anybody could have done this.
And what is the price for taking one of these mopeds to use?
I did some math. It's about a third of the cost of taking an Uber. They told me their typical ride is about 3 miles around Brooklyn and Queens and takes about 20 minutes, and that would cost you about $6.
We're speaking with Ann Cadet of the Wall Street Journal. Ann, your story talks about your experience trying to drive one of these mopeds. What happened?
I kind of knew it was a bad idea for me. I've never driven a motorcycle or a moped before, and Revel has free lessons available. But when I signed up last week, the first lesson available wasn't until August 9. So I thought, well, I'll just wing it. And I was talking to a friend who rides a motorcycle, and he said, Ann, this is not a good idea. This is not something you want to try for the first time in the streets of New York City. But I had a column to write. So I hopped on one, and I have a little kind of dead-end lane in the back of my apartment building. So I was just kind of zipping up and down that lane, which was actually was pretty easy to balance, and I was having a lot of fun. And then I tried to do a little U-turn in the lane, and I turned the throttle too hard, and I crashed right into a brick wall. So that was my very first experience. And then I tried a few more turns, and I took it out on the streets, and I was a little concerned about this one kind of busier street in my neighborhood. So I thought, I'll walk the scooter on the sidewalk for a block to avoid this kind of busy thoroughfare. And I didn't know to turn the throttle off, and I accidentally cranked it back a little bit, and the scooter leapt forward, and I yanked it back so it wouldn't, you know, jump out of my hands and hit somebody, and I turned it over on myself, and it pinned me to the sidewalk, and I had to wait there for a while until someone could come along and help me get out from under the scooter. So I got a little banged up, like I wasn't seriously hurt, but yeah. That's, it wasn't fantastic for me.
That's not a great story. I mean, yeah. If other people are inexperienced, it sounds like they could have the same problems.
I talked to one of Revel's co-founders, who actually, after I contacted with them, he gave me a free lesson, and that helped a little bit. And I said, you know, I don't really think somebody like me who's never been on a moped, I don't think I should be able to take it out on the streets without first getting the lesson. They are adding instructors so that there's more slots available, but they kind of pointed out that anybody who wanted to could actually, you know, buy a moped and drive it around. You don't need a special license for it like you do for a motorcycle.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenko with Wall Street Journal columnist Ann Cadet. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Underwear, socks, shirts, hoodies, sweatpants. Guys, we all have them, right? Of course we do. They're the staples of our wardrobes. How many times have you been in a department store looking at aisles and aisles of underwear and socks? Well, this is not the most invigorating shopping experience, right? You just want to grab and go, but you can't because you're kind of playing a game of roulette as to which ones are going to fit you. That's why they developed Mack Weldon. Mack Weldon is going to give you right now 20% off your first order. Go to MackWeldon.com and enter the promo code Gordon. Welcome to a stress-free, easy shopping experience that will guarantee you the best fit and the most comfortable top drawer apparel you'll ever own. Custom engineered fabric, detailed stitching, even odor eliminating underwear and socks make Mack Weldon the obvious choice. If you don't like your first pair of underwear, keep them. Get a refund. No questions asked. Mack Weldon, giving you 20% off right now on your first order. Go to MackWeldon.com right now and enter the promo code Gordon. Thanks for spending time with us. Coming up this half hour, the one couple that dreamed about frugally traveling around in a van until reality smacked them in the face. Funny story from the Wall Street Journal. Also, the difficulty of repeating as World Series champs. Exhibit A, this year's Boston Red Sox. And locals trying to help a troubled neighbor. This time it's a bear in Minnesota. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. If you've been doing something for 40 years as a career, you must be doing something right. Such is the case for our next guest, Bob Vila, whose name has been synonymous with home improvement since the 1970s. Earlier this year, the TV program This Old House on PBS, which Bob hosted from 1979 to 2003, marked its 40th year on the air. He's since launched a number of other products, including one-minute how-to updates sold by Compass Media, our parent company. Bob, take us back to how this began for you.
Well, I mean, it starts in 78, really 41 years ago, and if you keep going, I started renovating buildings in Boston back around 73, and that was my career goal. I was studying architecture at night to finish a degree that I'd started years earlier. And so anyway, after doing a few projects in the Boston area, a TV producer at the PBS station there had the idea that he wanted to create a show about renovating a house, and he saw an article on one of my projects in the Boston Globe, and the ball started rolling from there. I hosted the show for 10 years, and then, I can't believe these numbers, but 30 years ago, a new host took over, and I went and started a different show in syndication with CBS called Bob Vila's Home Again, which have had upwards of 40 million hits on YouTube in the last, whatever, 5 or 10 years. So it I guess in a nutshell, it just snowballed out of all proportion and turned into not quite America's favorite pastime, but a close second to baseball.
I thought that I read somewhere you studied journalism at the University of Florida. What was your original game plan?
My original game plan was architecture, and then midway through, I switched to communication sciences when I was, frankly, having a lot of trouble with some of the higher math requirements at the time in the curriculum.
Jeez.
And so I ended up with a with a degree in communication sciences, journalism. And from there, I was in the Peace Corps. I served in the Peace Corps for 2 years. And then I traveled abroad for 2 years, and when I finished with that, I really knew in my heart that I wanted a career in architecture, and that's why I went to Boston to study at the Boston Architectural College, where I did most of the work, but again, did not finish the degree because I was seduced by the business and by buying houses and doing all of this. And coincidentally, last year, the Boston Architectural College conferred their honorary degree on me after all these years, and I was the commencement speaker, and it was a great thrill.
That's fantastic. So these math classes you may have struggled at University of Florida, you couldn't tell those instructors, listen, I could give you a third-floor penthouse on top of your home in a weekend's worth of work. You can't help me out with a math grade here?
I don't think it worked that way. And I think the ethics are still the same. I simply was not cut out to be an engineer. I was cut out to be more of a designer.
We're speaking with Bob Vila. You know him from This Old House on PBS, now in its 40th year of broadcasting. He also does home improvement updates, which are sold by our parent company, Compass Media. There are now, boy, home improvement shows everywhere, even full-on, YouTube channels, cable TV channels dedicated to this stuff. Do you
networks, kind of,
yeah. Put your feet back up on the coffee table sometimes with your hands clasped behind your head and say, you're welcome?
No. I mean, you know, the audience is the market, and we created a huge audience for This Old House and for PBS, and I remember the producer making the comment about imitation is the most sincere form of flattery, and he mentioned it in a different way. But in any event, the fact of this kind of phenomena of interest in home improvement and construction and building and remodeling and interior design and everything goes with it is just a phenomenal kind of development that I did not foresee and that I certainly welcome.
Thanks, Bob. Bob Vila, home improvement expert. By the way, all three hosts of This Old House come together for a reunion celebration on PBS August 17. It's 21 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us, traveling the country, driving past cornfields and mom-and-pop shops until you reach the Grand Canyon, pulling up the trunk, kicking off your shoes and cracking open a cold one while dangling your feet into the dusty summer air, sleeping under twinkling lights. Seems like a picture-perfect life, maybe even one built for Instagram, right? But you better do your homework. It's a story by Maria LaMagna, personal finance reporter at MarketWatch, who's writing about hashtag van life, people who choose to live out of a van. Maria, what have you found?
Over the past couple of years, it's kind of been a growing movement, or at least a movement that people are interested in reading about. A lot of people are aspiring to live this van life. It's basically, you know, The New Yorker wrote about it in 2017, calling it the bohemian social media movement. It's basically when, you know, kind of just like it sounds, people sort of outfit a van or some type of RV and actually live in it either part-time or full-time, and often kind of chronicle their travels on social media as well. And it looks very beautiful and idyllic, driving to the Grand Canyon and sleeping under the stars, and all of that seems picture perfect, but maybe, you know, until you look a little bit closer.
So you profiled this one couple who has a daughter also that they had to kind of factor into the equation here. They seem to have thought it through, maybe not as thoroughly as others, but what were some of the things they ran into?
Yeah, so I spoke to this woman, Lisa, who said that she and her husband kind of dreamed about doing this van life, and they thought about just doing it for vacation, but they thought it would be really cool to have the freedom to, you know, drive all the way across country. And so they really thought about it for a while, and then they eventually bought a van for about $4,000, and they took the back seats out, and they created a little bed in the back, and they kind of outfitted the van to be up to their standards, and they tried to do a little bit of a sort of a trial run before their eventual idea, which was driving all the way across country to the Grand Canyon.
We're speaking with Maria LaMagna, personal finance reporter at MarketWatch. She's written a piece entitled, "This Couple Dreamed About Frugally Traveling Around in a Van Until Reality Smacked Them in the Face." It's a kind of a social media discussion called hashtag van life. So they ran into things like, what if the van breaks down? Do you have the tools on hand to fix it yourself, right? And they did not. What were some of the other factors here?
Yeah, so they were reading online before their big trip to kind of say, what do we need to, you know, prepare ourselves for? One of the things they thought about was how hot it's going to be. They decided to do their trip in the summer, and they were thinking, oh my gosh, how can we sleep at night when we don't have, you know, electricity on in the van? They also started researching how much it costs to actually park at a campsite, especially one with a water hookup and electricity. And once they started calculating that, they were like, oh my gosh, that's almost as much as staying in a hotel. They also started to get a little bit nervous about safety because, as you said, they have a young daughter, and they were reading in different forums that, you know, people recommend keeping weapons in your car and different things like that. So they just started thinking, oh, my gosh, what are we doing? You know, we don't want to put our daughter at risk if we're living in this kind of risky lifestyle and traveling all the way across country like this.
Is this tied to the FIRE movement of retiring early?
Yeah, they do have a lot of things in common. A lot of people who aspire to retire early also talk about van life and how that can either be a, you know, part of the plan. Maybe it helps you live inexpensively for a while and save a lot of money, or maybe that's sort of your end game. You know, both movements are really focused on being frugal and putting more weight in experiences than things, and sort of downsizing and all of these kind of trends that are taking over right now. So those both do have a lot of, you know, things in common, and they also both have huge sort of online followings of people dreaming about leaving their full-time work and the grind of daily life and doing something totally different.
Thanks, Maria. Maria LaMagna, personal finance reporter at MarketWatch. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend.
Family is big around here. We're family-owned, family-operated, family-managed. And that means legacy. That means dependability. That means using Grainger. With over 1.5 million products and knowledgeable product experts, Grainger has whatever we need. And with same-day pickup and next-day delivery options, they have it whenever we need it. For over 90 years, businesses like ours have trusted Grainger. Because, like family, Grainger's got our back. Call, click Grainger.com, or stop by to see for yourself. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey, Gledger with us. The Boston Red Sox once seemed a good bet to become the first Major League Baseball team since 2000. To claim back-to-back titles, but that's not panning out so far, at least in mid-July. Who can figure out the Red Sox? More from Jared Diamond, national baseball writer at the Wall Street Journal. Jared, set this up.
Just about every other sport, at least in the United States, has done it recently, but not baseball. There's not been a repeat champion in baseball in close to two decades. The last one was in 2000 when the Yankees won their third straight World Series after winning in 1998 and 1999. Since then, nothing. No one's been able to repeat, despite several teams or quite a few teams that went into the season looking like they'd be a great candidate to do it, only to see them come up short and sometimes come up far short.
Yeah. And money doesn't even seem to be a factor because, you know, the Yankees have the reputation of trying to buy their way to a World Series every year. That hasn't worked out.
Certainly not with the Red Sox either, the current Red Sox. Last year's Red Sox had the highest payroll in the major leagues. This year's Red Sox, if not the highest payroll, certainly in the top just two or three. They might even have the highest again at this point. So money does not seem to be a factor. It's I don't know if anyone really knows the reason why it's been so hard to repeat, although there's certainly a lot of theories.
Wow. You know, I think there was an old theory that used to say, what do you win, two-thirds of your games at home and at least go 50-50 on the road? The Red Sox have been terrible at home.
Yeah, it's strange. They've had a strange season in general. You know, they had a really slow start, which is not entirely uncommon for teams coming off a World Series championship. That's, in fact, quite common, where a team that wins the year before comes out in April and struggled. Since then, they've played a lot better, and they have sort of put themselves back into the race for sure. But the problem is they dug themselves quite a hole. You know, the Yankees have turned out to be perhaps the best team in the American League, and I think what surprised at least some people was how good Tampa Bay, the Rays, have been. The Rays are also ahead of Boston. So even at this point, the division seems almost out of reach for the Red Sox.
We're speaking with Jared Diamond, Wall Street Journal national baseball writer. His piece is called The Red Sox and Baseball's Unsolved Problem, How to Repeat as Champion. So you referenced Tony La Russa in here, he's like special advisor for the Red Sox or something like that. He called about every champion coach he could think of, it seemed, in the offseason to try to find the secret sauce.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So that was an offseason mission for the Red Sox. They knew that coming back after winning the World Series, teams frequently struggle, and they were trying to figure out why. So Dave Dombrowski is the Red Sox president of baseball operations. Had Tony La Russa, who's his longtime friend and now special advisor, and sort of uses expansive Rolodex to try to get some advice on maybe things to look out for, typical pitfalls, things that other managers and coaches from other sports have learned about trying to do it again. So he went out and called really everyone he knows.
Thanks, Jared. Jared Diamond, national baseball writer at the Wall Street Journal. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour. On this weekend, there is a bear evading wildlife authorities in Superior National Forest in Minnesota. His distinguishing feature is a heavy-duty plastic trash lid that he's wearing like a massive necklace. The Wall Street Journal says the bear, nicknamed Ringo, has been the subject of reports to the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources since late May, making him a walking, sniffing, foraging embodiment of what happens when wildlife and people move into each other's neighborhoods. Ringo is not interested in help, apparently, or may just prefer his accessory. Officials have tried to lure him into a live trap to no avail. He won't take the bait. Only two people at the State Department of Natural Resources are trained to use a tranquilizer gun on bears, and they're based too far away to reach Ringo quickly enough after someone relays his location, because Ringo then just moves on. Even if they could, darting an unrestrained bear is risky because the bear could run and hide before the tranquilizer takes effect. Meanwhile, a local couple submitted pictures showing Ringo without his garbage can necklace, but state officials haven't confirmed that it in fact is Ringo the bear. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business. But you don't have to take our word for it. Take Evan Lyles, CEO of Roush Enterprises, instead.
For the people that are involved in product development, there couldn't be more unique and exciting opportunities that are really going to shape the future of the world. It's a really exciting time to be in Michigan.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.